events on 9/11, the memorial at the Pentagon, and some other events. But thanks for coming. And as we go through the information today, I'll go slow enough. If anybody has any questions, feel free. I'll talk about the press kit initially. This press kit is a summary of what had happened on 9/11. So if you read it, it's about a 10-page summary. You'll get a complete view of what had happened on 9/11. Now, you'll notice that it doesn't match what happened in the 9/11 Commission report or the FBI IG report, the DOJ FBI IG report. And why is that? Because the information that was missing is this substitution for the testimony of John, which says clearly in that testimony that the CIA knew on July 23, that Midhar was going to take part in the next big Al-Qaeda operation. So they actually knew he was going to take part in the operation. Tom Wilshire is the same guy that was told on August 22nd that Midhar and Hazmi were inside the United States. So that's how that's related. The second thing I've got in here is the release given to FBI agent Dina Corsi. Now, again, if any of these people are new to you, you can ask a question, and I'll try to fill in who these folks are. The slides will also fill in who these folks are in a minute. And before we start, I'll give you my bio. I'm a engine. Okay. Hi, I'm Bob Schottmeyer, and I'll give you a little bit of my background. I'm an engineer and not a person in intelligence or having anything to do with intelligence. And when you read the book, it'll be obvious why I had worked on this issue and tried to put the story together. I have been in contact with the FBI probably on a dozen different occasions. I'd contacted the Joint Inquiry Committee of the House and the Senate, even contacted the leaders of that investigation, contacted the 9/11 Commission, talked to a number of the commissioners, and had given them summaries of FBI reports that I had summarized from having the interviews with the FBI. When I went to the April 14th hearings of 2004 and I heard George Tenet give his testimony, I decided that there was enough information that had been left out that I could write a book on it and wrote a book on it. And now I have found new information, quite a bit of new information, completely left out of both the 9/11 Commission report and the FBI IG report. When I put this new information together with those two reports, I came out with a completely different picture of what had happened on 9/11. And it will be stunning. And today that's what we're going to go over, the collage or the combination of the new information. And the new information were those two documents, the release to Dina Corsi, the testimony of John or Tom Wilshire, or the Tom Wilshire's information that he gave to the CIA managers in July. And the final thing that was missing is this thing called The Agent. This is a story, I might ask a question here. How many people have read The Agent in The New Yorker? So I'll go over that slowly. This is a story that was given to Lawrence Wright. Lawrence Wright's an author. And he'd been given this information by FBI agent Steve Bongart. Bongart was Ali Safan, FBI agent Ali Safan's assistant. And Ali Safan, even though he was only 29 years old, had been appointed by John O'Neill to head up the co-bombing investigation. And why Ali Safan is missing from the FBI IG report or the 9/11 Commission report, I'll never know. But Safan, being the lead investigator, I can't imagine how the FBI Inspector General didn't know who this guy was. And it turns out that Safan's information fills in all the missing details, combined with the other two reports that I described. And when you put this together with the FBI IG report, you get a completely different picture of what had exactly happened. Yes, it was released in 2004 and then in 2005. Now, it was redacted in 2005. Redacted, are you familiar with the term? They black out sections. It was released again after the Massawi trial in May of 2006. And I could explain why they had redacted it and why they released it after the Massawi trial if anybody's interested. Okay. So the missing information was the account of FBI agent Ali Safan. That had been dictated to Lawrence Wright, which is an author. He put some of that in his book called Looming Tower, but it actually ends up in this document here, which was the New Yorker article. And I had been putting this account together on 9/11 and couldn't figure out why I could just couldn't put the whole story together. And so when I saw that article, I knew immediately that it probably had information in it that I could use to finish up my story. The next thing that was missing from the 9/11 Commission report is the fact that George Tenet and Copher Black went to the White House on July 10th to tell Rice and Clark that there was going to be a gigantic attack inside the United States that was going to kill thousands of Americans. He was told by Rice to go talk to Rumsfeld and Ashcroft, which he did on the 17th of July. Now, that had been given to Richard Benvenista and Phil Zelico of the 9/11 Commission, but never ended up in the commission report. God only knows why. The second thing that was missing, or the third thing that was missing, was Tom Wilshire's emails to his CTC managers in July 2000. These emails clearly showed that the CIA knew that Midhar and Hazmi were going to take part in the next big Al-Qaeda operation.
Who is Tom Wilshire?
Tom Wilshire is the former deputy chief of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA. And Wilshire had been moved over to the FBI in mid-May 2001. And when he wrote this, he was actually at the FBI. And again, we can go into that in more detail in the end here. The third thing that was missing is the NSA release. Now, the fact that there had been a release was actually knowledge, was in the public. The fact that it had been released the very day Dina Corsi, this release had been given to an FBI agent at headquarters, FBI headquarters, Dina Corsi. The fact this had been released in the morning, the very day she tells Steve Bongard he cannot be part of the investigation for Midhar, is significant. Because when she tells Bongard that he can't be part of the investigation for Midhar because the NSA caveats prohibit him from getting NSA information, she'd already been given the release by the NSA for this information. The key people, if anybody has any questions on these folks, let me know. The key people are Ali Safan. He was the lead investigator in the Cole bombing. Steve, for the FBI, obviously the FBI. The Steve Bongard, who is his assistant. Now, Safan was off in Yemen trying to investigate the Cole. Steve was back in New York trying to put this together and investigate it from New York. Margaret Gillespie was an FBI IOS agent at the CIA Bin Laden unit. She's important. Doug Miller also worked in the same unit, and he's very important to the whole story. We have Clark Shannon, who was a CIA officer at the Bin Laden unit of the CIA. These people will come in peripherally. Michael Rowlands was head of the ITOS unit. Now, the reason I put all these people together is Rowlands, Wilshire, Corsi, Maltby, and Fresca all worked in the same group at the FBI. It's called the ITOS section. Wilshire was liaison to Rowlands. He'd been formerly at the Bin Laden unit. Corsi was an ISO agent at the Bin Laden unit. Maltby was a manager in the RFU unit. And Fresca. RFU is Radical Fundamental Unit. So if you're considered to be a radical, you're going to bomb something, but they don't know you're an al-Qaeda terrorist at the point, then you're going to the RFU unit. Later on, what we'll show is all of these people participated in sabotaging or stopping investigations of al-Qaeda terrorists that were inside the United States. So at the time they stopped these investigations, they were known to be an al-Qaeda terrorist. They were known to be inside the United States. Those investigations were stopped by the people on this one slide, if you can imagine that. I mean, so all the people that were participating in this were in one unit at the FBI. The key people from the terrorist side were Khalad, is his nickname. Actually, his name is Tawfiq bin Atesh. We have, he was actually the mastermind of the Cole bombing. We'll go down here and look at the other three, or the other four below. Khalid al-Midhar, Naref al-Hazmi, Salim al-Hazmi. And the three people that are important here are Khalid, Midhar, and Hazmi. They were the ones that were at the Kuala Lumpur meeting. They were on American 77. Hazmi and Midhar were on American 77 that hit the Pentagon. And the fact that Khalid bin Atesh had been at the Kuala Lumpur meeting, where the Cole bombing had been planned with Midhar and Hazmi, was critical, but that was the information that was withheld from the FBI. That information was withheld from the FBI until August 30th, 2001. And not only that, but it was withheld from the FBI investigators on the Cole bombing until after the attacks on 9/11. Had that information been given to those investigators, Bongard in particular, he would have gone after and investigated Midhar. But Bongard was never told about the fact that Benitez had been at the meeting with Midhar and Hazmi until after the attacks on 9/11. It's just mind-blowing. So the new information was the account of Safwan, and this information, which you can read in this little document here, describes the three times that he went to the CI and asked for information about a meeting in Kuala Lumpur and about Khalid Benitez. Tennant Black's White House meeting on July 10th and with Rice and Clark and on the 17th indicated to the highest officials in the U.S. government that the U.S. was about to suffer a terrific attack that would cause mass casualties in the U.S., mass civilian casualties. And I just want to emphasize the point here that it's important to notice that when the people on the bottom were preventing information from going to the FBI, people on the top already had the same information that these people on the bottom did. Tom Wilshire's July 5th, July 13th, and July 23 emails to CTC managers indicated that people at Kuala Lumpur were involved in the warnings of the huge attack the CIA had been getting, and that Midhar and Hazmi would take part in these attacks. So in July, the CIA knew that Midhar and Hazmi were going to take part in these enormous attacks.
And were also in the U.S.
Well, they didn't find out they were in the U.S. until August 22nd. On August 28th, the release from the NSA came over and was given to Dina Corsi. She got the release before she even talked to Bongard to tell him that he couldn't be part of the Midhar investigation because NSA prevented information from going to criminal investigators at the FBI. Now, by taking the information that I put in the book, you couldn't tell what had actually happened on 9/11. But what I did is I built timelines with this information and combined it with the information that was already officially available from the, it's called the Department of Justice Inspector General's report and the 9/11 Commission report. And when you built timelines combining this information with that information, you came up with an entirely different story, and you found out that the information that came from those other reports had missing holes in it. Those holes were filled in with this information. Now, the information that was ultimately withheld from the FBI Cole investigators was the fact that the meeting in Kuala Lumpur had taken place and that Khalid Benitez, Narif al-Hazmi, and Khalid al-Midhar and Narif al-Hazmi had been at that meeting. So the information is pretty simple. There were three people at the meeting. The meeting took place between the 5th and the 8th in 2001. They were known to be al-Qaeda terrorists. They were photographed. Numerous other terrorists were photographed at that meeting, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He was the mastermind of the attack on 9/11. Ramzi Ben al-Shib, he was at the meeting. He'd been photographed. Ramzi Ben al-Shib was from Germany, and three of his roommates were Marwan al-Shihi, one of the pilots that hit the South Tower, Mohammed Atta, one of the pilots that hit the North Tower, and Hazmi Jared, he was one of the pilots that hit the Pentagon. Now, this meeting was described in a cable sent to the CIA, FBI, and FBI Director Louis Freeh in December 1999. And it was described as an important planning meeting, al-Qaeda planning meeting. Everybody was photographed. They had video. All this information was given back to Tennant, George Tennant, and Kofor Black and the CI on January 9th, 2000. So there was plenty of information about the meeting, the people at the meeting. They'd all been photographed and documented. Now, on January 5th is when the actual events started happening, when this information from the Kuala Lumpur meeting was kept away from the FBI. And the very first time it was kept away from the FBI, and at this point it probably was not a criminal event, was January 5th when Tom Wilshire blocked FBI agent Doug Miller's cable. Miller had written a cable about Midhar, had his passport photo, had the fact he was going to Kuala Lumpur meeting, and it was written on the bottom, blocked by order of the deputy chief of the Bin Laden unit. And this is the first time that information from the Kuala Lumpur meeting was actually blocked from FBI investigators. The desk officer who worked for Wilshire sent out another cable and said this information had gone to the FBI when it hadn't gone to the FBI. Now, what's interesting is if you look at that, you'll find out that when they had been interviewed by the FBI IG investigators, both Wilshire and the desk officer tell the FBI IG investigators that they can't remember the cable, Can't remember why it had been blocked. Can't remember who had sent out another cable that said it had been blocked. And can't remember who might have told him to block this cable going to the FBI. So it's kind of a, has a lot of holes in it from their testimony. On March 5th, a cable was received at CIA headquarters that indicated that Naref al-Hazmi had entered the United States. He's known to have taken part in the attack on Tanzania and Kenya. He was known to have been a longtime al-Qaeda terrorist. And yet when this dangerous al-Qaeda terrorist enters the United States, nobody pays any attention to this cable. This cable was read by most of the people in the Bin Laden unit, including Tom Wilshire. But nobody did anything about it. Nobody watch list Hazmi, in spite of the fact he was known to be a longtime dangerous terrorist. In November 2000, when Safwan, Ali Safwan, had been assigned to the investigation of the Cole bombing, he flies over in October to Yemen and finds out that one of the main leaders of the al-Qaeda organization, Khalid Benitesh, had been responsible for buying the boat that had been used in the Cole bombing. And he sends a request to the CIA Yemen station. He says, give me any information the CIA has on Khalid Benitesh. And does the CIA have any information on an al-Qaeda meeting, planning meeting, in January of 2000? And he's told there is no information. Now, at that time, the Yemen station already knew there had been a meeting and already knew that Khalid Medhar and Naref al-Hazmi had been at that meeting. But he was told there was no information. Now, this is withholding material information from an ongoing FBI criminal investigation, which is, at this point, a crime. In November, he sends the same request to the director of the FBI. And he's told that there is no information at the CIA because the director of the FBI was supposed to give this to George Tenet, and he's just simply told there is no information at the FBI. In April, he sends the same request back to the CIA. Now, this is the third request, and again, he's told there's no information. So he's made three requests. The CIA has given him back information that there is no information at the CIA on either a meeting in Kuala Lumpur or this person named Khalid Benitesh. Now, this is interesting. In June 11th, the CIA and FBI hold a meeting in New York, and we'll go back when we review the criminal conspiracy to show you how the meeting had been connected to that April request. The meeting is held, and the photographs of Medhar and Hazmi are presented to the FBI Cole investigators. So they were presented three photographs. The photographs had Medhar and Hazmi in it. And Steve Bongart, who was at the meeting, was asked by one of the people from the CIA, do you recognize anybody in the photographs? And we're going to go through this in more detail in a second. On January 5th, Wilshire indicates that people from the Kuala Lumpur meeting are connected to the warnings of this huge attack that the CIA had been receiving. So now they know that people from Kuala Lumpur, which would have had been Medhar and Hazmi and the other people, are connected to this huge attack. On the 10th, we see that Tenet and Black call an emergency meeting at the White House with Rice and Clark on this enormous threat. Now look at how these dates are juxtapositioned. Wilshire knows on the 5th that people from Kuala Lumpur are connected to this huge warning. On the 10th, this information is given to Rice and Clark by Tenet. On the 13th, Wilshire asks his managers, can he send this information over to the FBI? So we've got the January 5th and the 13th where Wilshire is trying to get this information over to the FBI, the 10th where this information is going to the top people in the administration at the White House. So the dates are right lined up. On the 17th, Tenet and Black give this information to Rumsfeld and Ashcroft. And I don't know how many people remember it, but Ashcroft on the 26th quits flying on commercial aircraft. And he says it's because he releases a press release that says it's because of unspecified threats that he got from information from the FBI. But he won't specify what the threats are, but he quits flying commercial airplanes. And so on the 26th, there's Dan Rather, and it shows a little private plane talking, taking off, and here's Ashcroft flying this private plane. And nobody knows why, and the press never looked into it in detail to find out why he had been afraid to fly on commercial airplanes. I mean, after the fact we know, but not before. On the 23rd, Wilshire sends email to his managers, and he asks why his request on the 13th wasn't responded to transfer information to the FBI. And he indicates that Medhar will be found at the point of the next big al-Qaeda attack. Now, here the CIA knows, Wilshire knows, he sends it to his CTC managers, they know, and he's refused permission to give this information to the FBI. I mean, this is just stunning. On August 22nd, Margaret Gillespie, one of the people we mentioned here, finds out that both Midhar and Hazmi are inside the United States and gives this information to the FBI agent Dina Corsi and Tom Wilshire. Now, these two people are very important to the whole story here, so keep in mind the name Dina Corsi and Tom Wilshire, who is at the FBI in the ITOS section. On the 23rd, in spite of knowing that Midhar and Hazmi are in the United States, both Corsi and Wilshire work to sabotage any chance the Cole investigators, including Bongard, have to investigate Midhar. They just simply do everything they can, and I'll go through what they did to make sure that this investigation of Midhar was shut down completely. Now, the criminal conspiracies of the CIA that allowed this to happen were four, and they're arbitrarily put together here in November 2000. The request to the CIA, Yemen Station, November 2000, Safan's request to the director of the FBI, April 2001, Safan's request directly to the CIA. He made the same request again, the third request to the CIA. And the July-August period where the investigation of Steve Bongard and the Cole investigators are stopped by both FBI headquarters and the CIA agent, Tom Wilshire, working together. And we'll go through how they were able to stop that investigation. Let me just stop at this point and ask a question. Is anybody here feel like we're going too fast with this information or too slow, or what's your impression? About right? Okay. Now, remember, if you have any questions, feel free to stop and say, well, I forgot, who is this guy and what's his relationship to so-and-so? The first criminal conspiracy took part in November 2000. And in response to Safan's request, the Yemeni station told Safan there was no information at the CIA on any meeting in Kuala Lumpur or any information on Claude Bentesh. Now, that's a complete fabrication. At this time, Safan gives to the Yemeni station the passport photo of Claude. So now the Yemen station knows who Claude looks like. This passport photo was shown to a person which is called in these reports the FBI-CIA joint source. Now, we don't know who this person is, but he's considered to be a reliable source of information. Khalid is immediately identified as a high-level Al-Qaeda terrorist, a horrendously dangerous person. Now the CIA knows that Khalid Bentesh had been, who was identified as part of the Cole bombing, has been identified. Yes. So
if you could clarify that.
Yeah, they're trying Clay Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi Bin al-Shib, Khalid Bentesh, of course, Midhar and Hazmi, they can't try. They're terminated, obviously, in the attacks.
They're being tried by military?
They're tried by a military tribunal, and it's kind of a strange process. There will be information given at the trial that will be kept secret. It will be kept secret from you. It will be kept secret from me. It will be kept secret from the defendants. They won't even know what the information is. They have a process set up where press people will be at the Gitmo trial. If something is said in court that they feel is of concern to national security, they're going to stop the audio. Now, what could be so important after all these years, nobody can imagine. But I will tell you in the end what I think the information is that's secret. I think that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi Bin al-Shib had been at that meeting in Kuala Lumpur, and the CIA wants to keep that fact secret from the world. Because if people find out that these two high-level terrorists were at that meeting, were photographed and identified, and they would have been identified for sure, and the CIA didn't do anything about this information, this whole thing will just blow up into an enormous brouhaha, and the CIA wants to keep it well-controlled. Now, the Yemeni station in December sends a request to the Bin Laden unit and says, give us the photographs from Kuala Lumpur of Khalid Bentesh and Midhar. Now, this is December. They just told Safan in November they didn't have any information. Now they're going to the Bin Laden unit and getting these two photographs. And you go, oh, my God. So clearly, when they told Safan they didn't have any information, they clearly had as much information as they needed to, they could have given back to Safan. So the Bin Laden unit sends these two photographs back to Safan in December. In January, Khalid Bentesh is identified at Kuala Lumpur. Now, this is probably the most important event in the history of civilization. This ties Midhar and Hazmi directly to the planning of the co-bombing at Kuala Lumpur. The CI knows it. And what else does the CI know? They know they'd photograph these guys and let them walk away to carry out the co-bombing. So now, at this point, January 2001 is probably where the CI knows they're now culpable, criminally culpable in the co-bombing. So what are they going to do about it? They're going to keep it secret. All the people that knew about this, the Bin Laden unit at the CI, the Yemen station at the CI, the person identified at the CI called the handler for the FBI CI joint source, none of those people give this information back to either the FBI or Safwan. It's kept as an incredible secret. Even though they know that Safwan had made this request in November and know the identification of Benitesh had been as a result of Safwan's request, this information is kept completely secret. And unfortunately, because the planning of the attack on the World Trade Center and the planning of the attack on the coal took place at the same place, by hiding this information on the coal bombing, the CIA inadvertently hid the information that could have prevented the attacks on 9/11. Can you imagine that? Now, how many people are aware of this? And as you go into this, you'll realize how much of this information is not out in the public. In January 2000, all of these units know that Benitesh had been identified at Kuala Lumpur, know that Midhar and Hazmi had been there, and know that Midhar and Hazmi are now directly related to the planning of the coal bombing. Now, here's the stunner. This is the stunner of all time. Because he doesn't get any reaction from the Yemeni station, Safwan asks FBI Director Louis Freeh to please give him any to please contact George Tenet and find out from George Tenet had there been any information at the FBI, I mean at the CI, on a meeting in Kuala Lumpur or on Benitesh. And he's told there is no information at the CI on either Benitesh or a meeting in Kuala Lumpur. Now here's the killer. But Louis Freeh, the director of the FBI, already knew about the meeting in Kuala Lumpur himself. He didn't have to go to the CI, he knew about it. Because he'd gotten this information from the CI in January 2000. So not only did he get the information there had been a meeting in Kuala Lumpur, but he's told that Khalid El-Midhar had been at the meeting, and two other people named Narwaf and Salim had been at the meeting.
How do we know that Freeh was informed about the Kuala Lumpur meeting? What's the source for that?
The source for that is the following. The DOJ-IG report, page 239, 238, and 239, it tells you that the following. The NSA analyzed communications activities related to several members of an operational cadre. Now, operational cadre means al-Qaeda terrorists, in case this is CIA speak, so to speak. We're planning to travel to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia in early January 2000. Persons named Narwaf, Khalid, and Salim were involved. Now, in his January 4th briefing, he actually had the name Khalid El-Midhar, the whole name. Were involved at the FBI. This information appears in the daily threat update to the director of the FBI, on January 4th, 2000. And this statement appears in page 239 of the FBI IG report. It's called the Department of Justice, but it was actually their report on the FBI's involvement in trying to prevent the attacks on 9/11. So there it is. The director of the FBI had sabotaged his own investigation on the coal bombing. He committed a crime. Here's another report. This is in the 9/11 Commission report. The Counterterrorism Center at the CIA, now this counterterrorism is run by Kofor Black, had briefed the CIA leadership on the gathering in Kuala Lumpur, and the information had passed on to Director Freeh and others at the FBI. So it's not like I'm making any of this up. It appears in documentation. These documents are government documents. The director of the FBI had obstructed his own investigation of the coal bombing. And by not giving this information to the coal investigators, he was hiding the very information that could have prevented the attacks on 9/11. Now, let me just see a show of hands. How many people were aware of this? Anybody? Now, I'll just go through and add one little detail. I went to the FBI, and I confirmed this information with the FBI. FBI agents told me they remember clearly Ali Safwan talking to Louis Freeh, asking for this information. So it's not like it comes out of thin air. It actually comes directly from the FBI agents at the FBI. So it's clear that Free withheld material information. Now, if you commit a crime, you commit a crime if you withhold material information from an ongoing FBI criminal investigation. That's a crime right off the bat. And that was dreadful. Now, in April, Safwan sends the same request he sent to the Yemeni station, and to Free sends it right to the CIA headquarters. Now, he's going around Louis Free at this point. He's going directly to the headquarters. And in May, for some reason, after the CIA gets this request, they move Tom Wilshire over to the FBI. So Wilshire is a high-level person at the CIA. He's now moved over to the FBI. But he's moved over at kind of an auspicious time, right after this request comes in from Safwan. And you know, later on, you'll see why he'd been moved over. Now, I found out, and this took a little bit of work, that both Tom Wilshire, the guy we've mentioned several times here, and Clark Shannon, who is an officer at the CIA, had Safwan's request. And the book will go, if you go through the book, you'll see immediately how I proved that he had Safwan's request. But they did not give this information that Safwan had asked for back to Safwan. Now, here's what's interesting. This fact that they had this request is probably the most heavily guarded secret at the CIA. Nobody knows this, except now we know it. But the CIA never told anybody. 9/11 Commission report didn't find this. The DOJ, FBI, IG report didn't report this. This is the most closely guarded secret at the CIA. Now, in mid-May, we find that Wilshire obtains three photographs of Midhar from the CIA. Now, he's over at the FBI, so he asks the CIA for these photographs from Kuala Lumpur. And he's trying to identify Khalid in these photographs of Midhar. Now, we know there were two photographs at the CIA, the photograph from Kuala Lumpur and the passport photo of Khalid that Safwan had given the CIA. So how do we know which photograph they're using, or Wilshire is using at this point, to identify Benitez in the photographs of Midhar? It had to be Safwan's passport photo, right? Can anybody tell me why it had to be Safwan's passport photo? Because if it was the photograph from Kuala Lumpur, Wilshire would have realized immediately that Benitez was not in the same photograph with Midhar, but in a completely different photograph. But he was looking in the photograph with Midhar, trying to find the image of Khalid Benitez. There had been a cable that had been gone to the CIA right after the identification in January that said Khalid Benitez had been identified in the photograph with Midhar. That was a mistake in that cable. And Wilshire never realized that. So now we know from this information that Wilshire, clearly, who is a high-level person now at the FBI, had Safwan's request. But he never responded back to Safwan's request. Instead, he asks his friend, Clark Shannon, who's at the CIA, to get Corsi, now over at the FBI, who's working with Wilshire, to set up a meeting with Safwan's people to find out what they knew about Kuala Lumpur. Did they know about it? Did they know about Midhar? Did they know about Hazmi? So instead of giving them the information, now they set up this meeting that's going to be a sting, a CIA sting on the FBI. And what the CIA wanted to find out, had the Cole investigators in their investigation of Khalid Benitez, had they found out about Midhar and Hazmi? What did they know about them? Now, the meeting takes place on June 11th. Now, this is a very famous meeting. Who here is not familiar with that meeting? You're not familiar with the meeting. Well, there's a meeting in New York City. It was between Steve Bongart, other Cole investigators. Clark Shannon was there. Dina Corsi was there. If you can imagine this, Margaret Gillespie was there. So we have all these important people from the CIA and all the team from the FBI Cole investigating team. And the CIA had set that meeting up very carefully to try to find out if the FBI had found out about Midhar and Hazmi. That was the information they'd been keeping secret. Remember, from January 5th, 2000, they didn't want that information to go over to the FBI. And at this point, they were horrified that this information had gone to the FBI. Corsi shows the three photographs that we just described that Wilshire was using to find Khalid Benitez in the photographs of Midhar. She shows these to the FBI Cole investigators. And here's what's interesting. The CIA officer, Clark Shannon, asked the Cole investigators and asked Steve Bongart, do they recognize anyone in the photographs? And in one of the photographs is only Midhar and Hazmi, nobody else. So it was clear that The CIA wanted to know, could the Cole investigators identify Midhar and Hazmi? Had they found out enough about this that they knew who Midhar and Hazmi were? Now, of course, he claims that the CIA wanted to know if Fahad al-Kuzo had been at the Kuala Lumpur meeting, but if you read the book, you'll see that's just baloney. That was an excuse given to the FBI IG investigators, which was just ridiculous. He was the guy, he had been at Yemen, and when the coal was blown up, he was the guy sitting up in a window trying to photograph the bombing, and he overslept. So now we know that these al-Qaeda terrorists aren't superhuman, they sometimes oversleep. And he, after the Yemen attack on the USS Sullivan's, where the boat was trying to be blown up and they missed, the boat was so heavy with explosives it sank. He then was told to go to the meeting in Kuala Lumpur. Now, that attack on the Sullivans was January 3rd. The meeting in Kuala Lumpur was January 5th to January 8th. So he was immediately ordered to go to Kuala Lumpur, Kuzo, and he was going to carry whatever money was left over from the bombing of the USS Sullivans. He was going to carry it up to the Kuala Lumpur and give it to Claude Benitesh. Now the question is asked, who are these people? Oh, and Bongard asked these CIA agents, he says, who are these people in these photographs? Why is the CIA interested in them? And how are they connected to the coal bombing? Now, why would he ask that? Because these guys are the coal bombers, investigators. They want to know, why is the CIA asking the FBI investigators on the coal bombing about people that the coal investigators don't know anything about? And they want to know why this is relevant to their investigation. And what's so pitiful is when Clark Shannon was asking Bongard, do you know any of these people? He knew that Midhar had a multi entry visa for the United States. He knew it was labeled destination New York City. He knew Hazmi was in the United States. He knew that Khalid Benitesh, Midhar, and Hazmi had all been at the Kuala Lumpur meeting. And FBI agent Dina Corsi knew that. She knew that all these people had been to the Kuala Lumpur meeting and knew that Midhar was connected to the planning of the coal bombing. She says nothing to Bongard. She's an FBI officer at FBI headquarters. Bongard's an FBI officer in New York City. So why is an FBI agent in New York in the headquarters hiding information from agents in the field? Can anybody explain that?
Following orders.
Boy, I guess. Now, whose orders was she following? She's working at the FBI. But who is she reporting to? Tom Wilshire. And who is Wilshire working for? He'd already been told on the 13th and on the 23rd of July not to give this information to the FBI. So he's working for high-level CIA managers that we don't know who they are. But we do know that those managers had the same information that Tennant and Black had when they went to the White House. So we know there's a connection there that goes through this kind of this funny wall between the managers that Wilshire was being controlled by and the people who went to the White House. So Corsi and Shannon tell Bongard and the other agents that they can't share this information because of the wall. Now, who here hasn't heard of the wall? I'll explain it. There's a document. When you get a document from the NSA, it's got a thing on the front of it called the caveat. And the caveat's a statement. It said, this information cannot be given to FBI criminal investigators without written permission. Now, why is that on there? Because the NSA sometimes uses information that has what's called an FISA component. That's information that was derived from an FISA warrant. Now, let's say you're a terrorist, and we want to investigate you. We can get a warrant to investigate you if we think you're a terrorist. Now, that's less legal authority than if I investigate you because I think you're going to commit a crime. But if I take that document in based on an FISA warrant that says we think you're a terrorist, we can't use that in a criminal court. The court's going to say you don't have probable cause. This guy was going to commit a crime. So the NSA want to be very careful not to give information that had been derived with an FISA warrant to criminal investigators and have it accidentally end up in a court. Now, they could go ahead and get this released, but they'd have to request from the NSA to get it released. And if it had no FISA component, it would be released instantly. So the wall, this thing called the wall, was a fiction that could be overcome in a few hours by making the request to the NSA. Now, the name Midhar was actually given to Bongard, but no additional information was given to Bongard, so Bongard couldn't figure out who Midhar was. He didn't have his passport number, didn't have his birth date. But she claims that she couldn't give him any more information because of the wall. We now know the wall was a fiction, and I will show you in a minute why. And we're on June 11, 2001. We're still in the meeting. Shannon never tells anybody what he knows, and what he knows is that Hazmi is already in the U.S. He's a dangerous terrorist. He'd taken part in the Tanzania and Kenya bombing that killed over 200 people. He knows that Midhar has a multi-entry visa for the U.S. That's a visa that lets you come back and forth to the U.S. He knows that on the visa it says the destination is New York City, for God's sakes. And he knows that Benitez had been at the Kuala Lumpur meeting with both Midhar and Hazmi, which definitely connects them to the coal bombing and planning of the coal bombing, and he doesn't say anything to Bongard. And, I mean, how this could happen, God only knows. And he also knows that he's in the meeting because of Safan's request in April. So Safan makes an official FBI request. At this meeting, Shannon is withholding material information from an FBI criminal investigation. Now, let me just drop back here for one point. The 9/11 Commission report put this meeting in their report, but they never put in the fact that this meeting had been the direct result of Safan's request, or that Shannon or that Wilshire had that request. And by doing that, they leave out the fact that the FBI, the CIA is withholding material information from an ongoing criminal investigation. So from the FBI, or from the 9/11 Commission report and the FBI IG report, you can't tell there's a crime. When you put in the account of Safan, you now know there's a crime. So what's interesting is the very information that could have proved it was a crime was left out of these reports. And again, how would the FBI Inspector General not know who Safan was? He was the lead investigator on the coal bombing. And the 9/11 Commission had the same information that the FBI IG Inspector General had, because they shared the information. Just doesn't make any sense. And again, we go back over the fact that on the 23rd of July, Wilshire emails the CTC managers and he says, why haven't you responded to my request to send this information to the FBI? And oh, by the way, Midhar is going to be found at the point of the next big Al-Qaeda operation. On the 24th, Margaret Gillespie, who had been investigating this in her spare time, finds that the cable that Doug Miller had written, and also finds a cable that says this information had been given to the FBI when it hadn't been given to the FBI. So now she's starting to get a little bit more in tune here, what had gone on. And actually, in this whole story, Margaret Gillespie is probably one of the heroes. She found information. She was trying to do the right thing, and people around her, which she didn't suspect, were sabotaging her efforts. On August 21st, she finds that Hazmi is in the U.S. This is the same information that the CIA, Bin Laden unit, has had since March 5th. She is freaked out. She goes to the INS and finds that both Midhar and Hazmi are in the U.S. and finds that Midhar had come back to the U.S. on July 4th. She finds that Midhar and Hazmi had entered the U.S. on July 15th. Midhar had left, and he came back on July 4th, and she says, oh, my God. These two dangerous terrorists are in the United States. Now, here's the horrible part. On August 22nd, she goes back to the people who had been sabotaging these investigations, Dana Corsi and Tom Wilshire, and tells them that Midhar and Hazmi are in the United States. At that point, Wilshire takes the investigation of Midhar away from Gillespie and gives it to Corsi. But Wilshire knows at this point, because of his July emails, that Midhar and Hazmi are in the U.S. to take part in this gigantic attack. But he'd given this information to his CTC managers on July 23, so they all know this. And now here's what's interesting. At the CIA, when information goes up to the management level, a small management level, it goes right to the top. So now everybody at the CIA knows that Midhar and Hazmi are in the U.S. to take place in this huge attack. But does anybody tell Bongard? Does anybody tell any of these criminal investigators that, oh, my God, these guys are here, we're going to be attacked? And the information about this attack was pouring into the CIA, and it was so horrific that, like I say, on July 10th, Tenet and Black go to the White House and say, my God, we're about to have this huge attack. And then on the 13th, they deny Wilshire the chance to give the very information that could have prevented the attacks on 9/11 to the FBI. Can anybody explain that? And I'll just stop here and have a slight anecdote. Bob Woodward, does anybody here know Bob Woodward? He was actually out at San Francisco in October of 2006. He was in front of the Commonwealth Club. He was pitching his book, State of Denial. And there were 1,200 people there, so they told everybody, don't go up and get your autograph or his signature. So he was standing there by himself, and I go up and I say, I'm Bob Schottmeyer, and I'm writing this book. And you're an expert on 9/11. He says, yes, I am. I said, well, you know who Tom Wilshire is? And he says, well, he's not quite sure. And I said, you describe a meeting in your book that Tenant Black went to Rice on the 10th of July and tell him there's a big attack. I said, well, Wilshire on the 13th asked the CTC managers, which would have had to been Kofor, one of them had to been Kofor Black, can I transfer information over to the FBI on the Kuala Lumpur meeting? That would have prevented 9/11. And he's denied the permission. And I said, Bob, can you explain that? And Woodward sat there, and I never saw anybody so flustered in my whole life. He said, well, you know, every time you look at this, you can always peel back another layer of the onion. So he clearly didn't know this information in the beginning, but he had no explanation why this was taking place. And yet he's the guy that's supposed to have the inside contacts to the point he can figure out how to get the information to put these things together. So now here's what's interesting. On August 22nd, Corsi calls the New York office. This is the FBI office, and says the CIA will send the photographs of Midharn Hazmi over to the New York office on the 23rd, and that the CIA has the photograph of Khalid taken at Kuala Lumpur. Now, that photograph connected Midharn Hazmi to the bombing of the coal bombing. Now, she doesn't give the photograph to the FBI agents. She just tells them. So we now know, and this is actually in the report on page 301, so we now know she knows about the photograph. And this is critical. This is Corsi, and she called the New York office and says the CIA is going to send you the August 22nd, and she says the CIA has the photographs of Midharn Hazmi. They're going to come over to the FBI on August 23rd, and oh, by the way, they have the photograph of Benitez taken at Kuala Lumpur. And what's amazing is now she hides this information from Steve during the next couple of days, but this is the proof right in page 301 that she knew about the photograph. She contacts the head of intelligence of the New York office and says it is urgent they start an intelligence investigation. Now, why is that? Because she wanted the criminal investigation shut down. To get that shut down, they had to do an intelligence investigation that she thought would be ineffective. On the 23rd, the intelligence people say they are going to start an intelligence investigation. At that point, she knows now they can shut down Bongard's investigation, that it makes it that much of a stronger case to shut down Bongard's investigation. And Corsi emails Wilshire and says the FBI intelligence will open an investigation of Midhar. Now, Corsi doesn't even work for Wilshire. She has nothing to do with Wilshire. He's the liaison to Michael Rowlands. He's the guy who's head of the ITOS unit, who's in charge of her whole entire group. And liaison is the person at the FBI from the CIA who's supposed to give information from the CIA to be used in FBI criminal investigations. So all of a sudden she's doing his bidding, sending email to him when she works for Rod Middleton, who's her boss. She doesn't even work with her boss. She's working with this guy. Now, how this happens, nobody can even figure out. At least I couldn't figure out. How is it that this guy is able to control Dina Corsi, an agent at FBI headquarters? Nobody has figured out, when it should have been Rod Middleton giving her directions. On the 23rd, the photographs come over, but the CIA and FBI headquarters, the ITOS unit, she continues to hide the photograph of Benitez taken at Kuala Lumpur, the photograph that connects these Midharn Hazmi to the planning of the coal bombing. On this date, Gillespie now requests that the Bin Laden unit issue a worldwide alert for Midharn Hazmi. Now, what happens at the CIA when you issue a worldwide alert? It goes where? It goes right to the top. Within hours, Tenet and Black know there's a worldwide alert for Midharn Hazmi and know they're in the U.S. They had to know they were going to take part in this huge attack. Because in July, they'd given information that a huge al-Qaeda attack is about to take place in the U.S. On the 23rd, they know that Midharn Hazmi, two longtime al-Qaeda terrorists, are in the United States. They're here, obviously, to take part in the attack. I mean, why else would they be here? Were they going to have a holiday in New York City? I don't think so. Now, here's what's even more horrific. On the 24th of August, Wilshire receives email from Maltby and Fresca. These are, we have the I2S section, and we have two units, the RFU unit and the Ben Lahn unit. Corsi is in the Ben Lahn unit. In the RF unit is Maltby and Fresca. These are the two guys that are shutting down Harry Sammet's investigation of Massawi. So now the guy who knows Midhar and Hosmer are in the U.S. to take part in this huge attack are making contact with the two guys that are sabotaging Harry Sammet's investigation, and he's trying to find out how the investigation on Massawi is going. I mean, the guy has all the information to stop 9/11 right there. He knows there's an al-Qaeda terrorist in the U.S., Massawi, trying to learn how to fly a Boeing 747 with no pilot training, and he has 2 4-inch knives on his possession when he's arrested. He knows Midhar and Hosmer are in the U.S. about ready to take part in this huge attack. He doesn't tell anybody this. He keeps this a complete secret. Now, on the 23rd of August, everybody at the CIA who'd received Gillespie's cable the day before knows the same information. So now we know what people at the CIA are aware of. None of this information had come out of the 9/11 Commission report, if you can imagine that. So Wilshire knows that Midhar and Hosmi knows about Massawi, doesn't say anything to anybody, doesn't tell Bongard, "Oh my God, guys, we're going to have a huge attack here, and these two guys are going to be part of it. Let's do something to figure out how we can prevent this thing." On the 27th, now this is really amazing. Now, if you get this little document, it's got this release in it. On the 27th, Corsi asked for a release from the NSA, from these caveats, so she can give this information. In this document, you'll see that the release says it's so they can give information to the FBI criminal investigators on the co-bombing. This is essentially going to eliminate the wall. She gets the approval the same day, but the release isn't sent to her until the 28th, and that in this document is the release on the 28th. It says all restrictions from the wall have been removed. She can give this information from Kuala Lumpur, which is going to stop the attacks on 9/11, to the FBI criminal investigators. Now, she was writing up an EC to start an investigation for Midhar, and that goes over to the investigators in New York on the 28th, and it's marked routine, even though she called up the head of the intelligence on the 22nd and said it was urgent. Now it's marked routine. Routine means it's got no priority, zero priority. Nobody's going to look at it. But this accidentally goes to Steve Bongard. So when it came in, the people of the FBI didn't know exactly where it should go, and they ended up giving it to FBI agent Steve Bongard. So now he's got this EC from Corsi on Midhar. He immediately calls Corsi, and he says the investigation for Midhar should come to him. He's got a whole team of people. They can go find Midhar quickly. He knows Midhar's in the U.S. to take part in a huge attack. He is told by Corsi that he and his team cannot be part of this investigation because the NSA wall prevents him from having any NSA information, even though Corsi had just gotten the release that same day, that morning, lifting this restriction. So the very day she's told she can give information to Bongard, she tells Bongard he can't be part of the investigation because they can't give him the information from the NSA. And like I say, I've got the release in there. When you see the release, you just you're sick. By hiding that information that she'd gotten the release from Bongard, 3,000 people are going to go up in smoke on September 11th. Bongard says, on August 28th, when Bongard is told he can't be part of the investigation for Midhar, he says, "I think you've got something wrong. This information that came from the NSA doesn't have anything to do with FISA. So go to the lawyers at the FBI. They're called the NSLU unit. NSLU unit. These are the lawyers. And get a ruling, and then I can have the investigation back, and I can go investigate Midhar. And if he is going to take part in a big al-Qaeda attack, I'll stop it." But on the 29th, Corsi comes back and tells Bongard that the NSLU has ruled he and his team cannot have any part in the investigation for Midhar. Now, that you would think that would end it right there, right? Unfortunately, she made it up. Corsi made up this testimony. Sherry Sable, the NSLU attorney, denies ever giving this advice to Corsi. She said since the NSA information was not connected to FISA, this information could go to Bongard, and further states, if Corsi wanted to give this information to Bongard, all she had to do is get an NSA release. This is on the 29th. So the attorney was never told that Corsi had gotten the release, because she tells the investigators that she could have gotten the release, and she'd got the release in less than one day. So now we know they've been hiding the photograph of Benitez. They hid the fact that there was a release from the NSA, and now they fabricate the testimony from the NSLU attorneys to keep Bongard off this investigation. Because of this, 3,000 people on the 29th are now doomed to die on the 11th of September. There's no hope for him at this point. There's no way Bongard's going to be able to mount an investigation to find him in time. And I just want to ask you a question. What do you think of this? I mean, this is horrific, I would assume. That's an excellent question. Okay, and no, you've got an extremely good question.
Could you go ahead and identify yourself and ask your question again?
Kent Klein, Voice of America.
Hang on.
Kent Klein, Voice of America. What was the motive behind all this?
Well, it turns out there were three motives. And the motive actually, I think our mic isn't too good here. I'll just repeat the question. What was the motive for hiding this information from the FBI and even hiding it when they knew that all these people were going to die in this huge attack? It turns out it's kind of a strange story of CYA. We know that this information was hidden on January 5th. Now, we don't know why it was hidden on January 5th, 2000. But then in November of 2000, we know the CIA knew immediately they were responsible for the coal bombing. So at that point, there was a huge effort at the CIA to hide any of this information from the FBI to prevent embarrassment because they had been culpable in the coal bombing. The meeting on June 11th, 2001 was put together because the CIA was just horrified this information had gotten out and gotten to the FBI investigators. Unfortunately, after August 22nd, when they know that Mihdhar and Hazmi are in the U.S. to take part in this huge attack, they still continue to hide this information, knowing that all these thousands of Americans are going to perish in this gigantic attack. So they start on January 5th, and I'll go into that in a second, continue on into the coal bombing. They know they're responsible for the coal bombing. Now, on August 22nd, when they know Mihdhar...
How are they responsible for the coal bombing? How do you go from January 5th, when they're monitoring and invasion summit meeting of these alleged Al-Qaeda terrorists, to this presumption or statement that they're responsible...
Well, because they photographed every person there, identified them, and didn't give this information to the FBI. They let them walk away and carry out the coal bombing. Well, that's a good question. Now, we know that this whole thing started on January 5th, right? And that up to October, there was no coal bombing. The coal bombing happened in October. So after that point, they were culpable in the coal bombing, or they knew they were culpable. So why did they hide this information from January 5th to October? That's a good question. What would be your answer? Well, what I found is that Mihdhar's father-in-law was the number that had been monitored by the NSA. That's the number that they found out when they found out that meeting in Kuala Lumpur. And they had monitored that number because that number was connected to the Tanzanian-Kenya bombings. So we now know that Mihdhar and his father-in-law are directly connected to the Tanzanian-Kenya bombings. Now, who else was connected to the Tanzanian-Kenya bombings?
When were the Tanzanian-Kenya bombings?
They were in 1998, in August of 1998. So now they know that Mihdhar is connected to the Tanzanian-Kenya bombings. Well, who else was connected to the Tanzanian-Kenya bombings? Ali Mohammed. Who is Ali Mohammed? Does anyone here know who Ali Mohammed is? He was the high-level al-Qaeda terrorist that worked at the CIA and worked at the FBI. He had been arrested in 98 after the Tanzanian-Kenya bombings, brought into the U.S. under the name John Doe, and hidden. And I think the CIA realized when they realized Mihdhar was at that meeting, they said, oh, my God, if his name goes over to the FBI and the FBI says, we're going to arrest this guy, that would lead right back to Ali Mohammed, and Mohammed's name would be exposed, and the fact that he was in the CIA and in the FBI would be exposed, and the FBI had already gone through Robert Hansen, Aldrich Ames, and they just didn't want to face another embarrassment. So I think the whole thing started to hide the fact that Mohammed and Mihdhar were connected. Now, that's a theory and a supposition and has no proof. But as far as I could put together, that's as good as I can come up with. Now, if you can come up with something better, give me your answer. But I couldn't figure out why would they start hiding this information on January 5th? And who had they already given this information to? They'd already given it to Director Louis Free. So it had gone to the director, the very top of the FBI, but they didn't want it to go to the criminal investigators of the FBI. Why is that? Because they could not corrupt those criminal investigators. If that information on Khalida Mihdhar went to criminal investigators, it would start a criminal investigation and it would be all over the newspapers. Yeah. Now, that's the best I could come up with. I mean, but you can see this whole thing started because they wanted to protect Mihdhar's name, and then they know they're responsible for the coal bombing. But what's so horrific when they know in August 22nd that Mihdhar and Hazmi are in the U.S. to take part in this gigantic attack, they know thousands of people are going to die, they still hide the information. And not only do they hide the information, they shut down Bongard's investigation with phony reasons. There's no release when they got a release. They're hiding the photograph of Benitez, and they fabricate the testimony of Sherry Sable. I mean, my God, about the fact that her ruling had said he can be part of the investigation, and Corsi tells Bongard, you're not allowed to be part of the investigation because the attorney had ruled you're not allowed to be in the investigation because of the NSA caveats. And if you go into my book, you'll actually see the testimony there that, in fact, if you read the summary, I actually got it in the summary. Bongard actually tells Corsi, I think you've got something wrong. This information has nothing to do. Now, if you go to the 29th in the summary, the August 29th, he tells Corsi, I think you've got something wrong. This information from the NSA has nothing to do with the FISA. Why are you telling us not to shut down our investigation? Corsi said, if you have one piece of paper at the FBI with your name on it and Mihdhar's name on it, you're out. You're fired. Your pension is over. You're dead. Corsi told Bongard, if one piece of paper appears at the FBI with his name and Mihdhar's name, he's dead. He's out. He's finished. Bongard is out. Now, how do we know that? Because that appeared in September 22, 2002, in the Joint Inquiry Committee hearing where Bongard was there, Wilshire is there, and Rowlands is there. And Bongard said, I was told if one piece of paper appeared at the FBI with my name and Mihdhar's name, I'm dead. On September 11th, when this huge attack takes place and Bongard knows that Mihdhar and Hazmi were involved, he goes down to the FBI computers and finds enough information in a few hours to locate Mihdhar. Had he been given the permission to locate Mihdhar, he had an entire team of people, he could have done it in days, and he had weeks. This is almost 2 weeks. August 28th is almost 2 weeks ahead of the attacks on 9/11. And when you realize this, it just makes you sick. And how many people know this? I want to see a show of hands. How many people knew this beforehand? How many people in America know this today? Well, we have five of them here. So the attorney was even aware that Corsi had received a release because she tells Corsi, if there's an issue here and if you're still confused, go to the NSA and get a release. She was completely unaware that she'd already gotten the release. But this is horrific. He is told if there's even one piece of paper at the FBI, he's just dead. Yeah, on the 29th, Corsi tells Bongard if even one piece of paper is ever found at the FBI, with his name and the name Khalid El-Mihdhar, he's over, he's finished. Headquarters will kill him. And here's what's so amazing. So in September 22, 2002, he's at the hearing. He tells Senator Dianne Feinstein, Senator Carl Levin, there's no way in the world this wall should have prevented this information from going to me on the FBI coal investigation. These two senators are sitting there hearing Steve Bongard say this. And yet in the 9/11 hearings, we're told that the excuse is given the wall. And yet we find out from this investigation that Corsi got a release from the wall in less than one day. So the wall was clearly a fiction. If there was no FISA information, you could pass through the wall in less than one day. All you had to do is get them to give you the release. And Feinstein heard this, Carl Levin heard this, and neither one stepped in to make sure that the 9/11 Commission hearings found out why this information didn't pass through this fiction called the wall. And I can't understand why Congress people would have so little regard for the American people that they wouldn't go back and say, we've got to have a thorough investigation, and this wall looks like a complete fiction. Let's make sure people investigate this. Now, you folks here are the first people on planet Earth to know the entire story. the story is actually summarized in the summary, and of course it's in, given in more detail in the book. But I mean, it's just stunning. On the 30th, now can you imagine this? She's taken away the investigation of Midhar from Bongard. They finally then, after there's no possible way Bongard can have anything to do with this investigation, the photograph of Benitesh is sent over to the New York unit. Now, Bongard didn't even know that until after 9/11. Yeah, and apparently I don't. God only knows where it went, but it didn't go to Steve. He wasn't even aware of this until after 9/11. Now I called the FBI investigators to check my information, and I said, "Were you aware on August 29th or August 28th when Corsi told you that you could not have anything to do with this FBI investigation of Midhar? Were you aware that Corsi knew there'd been a photograph at the CIA and knew the CIA was hiding this photograph?" And he said, "Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And where the hell had you gotten that?" And I said, "It's right in the FBI IG report." And he just went, "Oh, my God." And I said, "Were you aware when FBI agent Ali Safan asked Louis Free on November 2000 if there had been a meeting in Kuala Lumpur and had they had any information on Claude Benitesh? Were you aware that Free already knew there had been a meeting in Kuala Lumpur and already knew that Cleto Midhar had been in the meeting?" He says, "Oh, my God." And then he said, "Well, you know, people at that level just don't have good memories," which is obviously an important requirement for the job at that high level. On the September 11th, we had the attacks on 9/11, and almost 3,000 people were killed. And as you went through the slides, you could just see again and again where these FBI criminal investigators wanted to investigate this. They knew Midhar was no good. They knew he was a terrorist. They knew it could cause massive damage in the U.S. And the FBI agents at headquarters intimidated him out of this investigation. Harry Sammet was given permission for a search warrant after the Pentagon was hit. After they hit the towers, he was told he can't have an investigation of Massawi. When they finally hit the Pentagon, they said, "Oh, yeah, now we can give you a search warrant." Within days, he went into the duffel bag, found the fact that Ramzi bin al-Shib had given a receipt for $14,000 to Massawi, found the connections between all these terrorists in a matter of a couple of days, two or three days. Now, Sammet had been asking for the search warrant since August 17th, almost a month ahead of the attacks on 9/11. If he'd been given the search warrant, he could have gotten these attacks prevented. Remember that Malpe and Fresca worked for the RFU unit, reports to Rowlands. Corsi works for the Bin Laden unit, also reports to Rowlands. And Tom Wilshire is the liaison to Rowlands. His job is to give CIA information to FBI investigators to be exploited in FBI criminal investigations. Now you tell me what went on. So on at least three different occasions, they withheld material information from an ongoing FBI investigation. That's a crime. Now, at this point, we know it's a crime, but are they going to be prosecuted? God only knows. And they continued to withhold this information even after they knew all these people would die in this huge attack. And at this point, it's just sad. And I think today the American people are still unaware of this. I mean, does anybody, I'm just asking you a question. Do you think that people are aware of this today, even today? Isn't this amazing? And the American people have been told that they're in immense danger from a small group of dedicated extremists that had literally breached every single defense of our security, and that to be protected, they have to give up their rights, the right of habeas corpus, the right of this, the right of that. They're going to try all these terrorists. They're not going to allow them to have habeas corpus. They're going to give them secret evidence. The problem is if they can do that with terrorists, they can do that with you and me. I mean, our rights just go away. If you take away your right of habeas corpus, they can put you in jail, and there's nothing you can do about it. You'll be in there for the rest of your life. But these attacks, now we can see, were allowed to take place because of criminal actions at both the FBI and CIA, actions that had prevented very dedicated professional FBI criminal agents from protecting American people, and all the loss of these rights isn't going to make us any safer, which is the sad thing. And thank you very much. If you have any questions, feel free. If you want a set of these slides, I can email them to you. But I think the facts stand for themselves. You can see as we went through the slides, every slide had a page from either the DOJ report, the Safon's account, the 9/11 Commission report, the evidence that came out of the Massawi trial. Now, those documents that I showed you in this book came from the Massawi trial. The account of Safon was given to Lawrence Wright by Steve Bongard and was vetted by FBI information officer John Miller. So he checked the accuracy for that report and made sure it was accurate. That is the official account, yeah, from the FBI, yes.
And before we take the first question, Robert, could you please give us your website and say the title of your book and how people can contact you and order your book?
Now, the book is this book right here. It's 650 pages. The book is 650 pages, and it details all this, and it goes through a very detailed timeline. And how I put it together is I took all these reports and I just added information in there. Of course, I put this date and then I put more information in it. But without these account of Safon and without these two other documents, you wouldn't have figured this whole thing out. And if you look at the FBI IG report and the 9/11 Commission report, you get a completely different picture of this whole thing. And as I started putting this together, I went, oh, my God, oh, my God. I just the whole thing got more horrible and more horrible. And I'm not – the website is www.eventson911.com. .com. So www.eventson911.com, and you can get the book, all the material in the book, all the source documentation, the DOJ IG report, the account of Safon, a summary, the slides is all on there, and it's called the press kit. So anything you want on that website, you can get the book. You can order the book. It cost me about $20 to make the book, and I sell it for $30 because I have to ship it out. And so I'm not here to make money on the book. The last thing I want to do is make money on the book. Now, the last thing I want to say is, why am I doing this? You might ask that question. I had known about the attacks on 9/11 on February 11, 2001. I knew every detail. I knew they were going to hijack four planes. I knew they were going to hit the World Trade Center. And I knew the attacks would take place in the first 2 weeks of September. If you want to see how I did it, it's all detailed in the book. Knew every detail. What could you do? What in the world could you do? Every day I wanted to go to the FBI, and every day I said, I don't have enough information to go to the FBI to get any credibility to even get through the first interviewer. The problem with the FBI is you got to go in there and get them to believe you and then get that to pass on to the second person. And I couldn't figure out. See, when you read the book and how I put it together, I had no proof. I just had information the terrorists had written. And it analyzed that information to put this all together. But and you'll see there was one big hickey in this whole thing. I was going to have to tell the FBI they're going to have to go down to these airports, Logan, Dulles, and Newark, the last week of August and the first 2 weeks of September, and look for terrorists, al-Qaeda terrorists, Middle Eastern people, surveying these checkpoints to try to figure out how to get those 4-inch knives through security. And starting in September 1, they were going to have to look for four airplanes with 4 to 5 Arabs on these airplanes. And I literally could see the guy looking at me and saying, well, Bob, that's racially profiling. This man's FBI can't do that. We're dead. Your information is no good. What else can you have to prove they're going to be part of this huge attack? And the problem is that he was right. The FBI literally could not racially profile people. They couldn't do it. It was against the law. Ashcroft said it was against the law. What could they do? And I knew that the FBI agent that looked at me knew that he couldn't do anything with the information, and he just simply told me, Bob, this information is no good. Now, the FBI has told me I'm not at fault for these attacks. I got that directly from the FBI. Right after it happened, I went down there and told them the whole thing, and they said, Bob, we don't believe you're at fault. I have a letter here, and I'll bring up the letter. And I just wanted.
Did you deduce this? You basically followed some clues that were part of the public record.
Oh, it's
allowed you to put together a scenario that you believe was unfolding based on just public knowledge. Is that right?
Well, the horrible part of it is when you see how I put it together, you couldn't come to any other conclusion than they were going to smash those buildings to smithereens. Well, that was not even the half of it. They had written statements that all you had to do is analyze the statements and figure out what they meant. And I'll tell you, I'll give you the statement here. This is the statement I actually analyzed on an airplane flight coming from Narita, Japan, going to San Francisco, then back out to New York. Now, I'll just read this statement here. I would have to agree with the FBI that you, this guy is Rick Sinigrani. He was in charge of the Joint Inquiry Committee of the House and Senate for a short time. It was first a CIA agent. They fired him. This guy took over, and then Helen Hunt took over from this guy. I would have to agree with the FBI. You bear no personal responsibility for the attacks on 9/11. There were other information, including the 93 bombing at World Trade Center, indicating that the towers were a continuing target for terrorists because of their symbolic value. As you report, the FBI has told you, your report without specific details that you could not have known would not likely have been sufficient to change the outcome. I can assure you that the point you are making about the need to better inform the American people has not been lost on us. In fact, I am attaching the last of a series of public statements, blah, blah, blah. This is the guy who is in charge of the Joint Inquiry Committee of the House. He agrees with the FBI that I couldn't have done anything. Now, on the date when it happened, I was in a demo, giving a demo of my software, because I'm a software, I'm in charge of a software company. When it happened, I just went, oh, my God, I killed them all. Went back to my hotel and thought, I've just killed all those people. I killed 6,500 people. And I thought to myself, but why am I at fault? Why is it all my fault? I'll take a certain responsibility for this, but the FBI and CIA have to feel like they're responsible too, right? And I could come up with nothing about the CIA in my mind that I could even indicate that they had been trying to stop this attack. Now, when I had put this together on an airplane flight, I was sitting there thinking, oh, my God, this is so obvious. They're going to smash those buildings to smithereens. The FBI has to know about this. How can I sit there and figure it out? And they've got 25,000 people, and they couldn't figure it out. This doesn't make any sense to me. I'll read you the statement. To kill Americans and their allies, both military and civil, is an individual duty of every Muslim who is able in any country where this is possible. By God's leave, we call on every Muslim who believes in God and hopes for a reward to obey God's command to kill Americans and plunder their possessions whenever he finds them and wherever he can. You could put the entire thing together from that. Didn't anything else. That was it. That had been issued by Al-Quds Al-Abira. It was a statement by Al-Qaeda on February 23, 1998. You didn't need any more information, just that. Now I'm going to ask one question. Who wrote that? That was written by Sheikh Abdul Rahman, the guy that hit the World Trade Center in 1993. And the CIA had that statement in 1998, right after it had been issued, and knew Rahman had issued it and knew it was a declaration of war against the United States. And 3 years later, they hadn't put it together. When I came upon that statement, I put the entire plan together in 3 hours, every detail. And then I went through every detail to try to figure out if I could prove it wasn't going to happen. And instead of proving it wasn't going to happen, it proved it was going to happen. When I got off the plane, I was just mortified. I didn't know what to do. But when you read the book, you'll see exactly you'll see there was a systematic process from going from that statement to virtually every detail in the attack on 9/11. Not a haphazard process, a systematic process. You could take that statement and just go down a path and say, okay, what are they going to do here? What are they going to do here? What are they going to do here? What's the target? How are they going to plan? What's the method of attack? When's it going to take place? What could you do to stop it? I mean, I could go to the FBI and they were just going to sit there and do nothing. So any more questions? So I guess the question is Tom Wilshire and Steve Bongard? Wilshire's still at the CIA as far as I know. Corsi's still at the FBI as far as I know. And dear old Steve, they put him out to pasture.
What do you mean pasture?
Well, they have an organization in Quantico, Virginia, called a school for FBI agents. Anybody that had anything to do with the 9/11 got moved down there kind of to be incommunicado so that people couldn't talk to him. And Safon was so disgusted. He realized that he had been sabotaged by the CIA. He was so disgusted, he quit immediately. And he's actually working for Giuliani Partners, which is Rudy Giuliani. And he got shipped out of the country immediately, and he's over in a foreign country in the Middle East now working on security, but he got moved right out of the country. Now, Safon appeared again just recently. Are you familiar with Hamdan, the guy they just indicted? He was the driver for bin Laden. Ali Safon was at the trial. So just a few weeks ago, he was in Guantanamo testifying, and the testimony pretty much showed that Hamdan knew nothing about these attacks. He was told after the attacks that he overheard a conversation between bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, and one of them said, well, we were much more pleased about the attack because we only thought 1,500 people would be killed and 3,000 were killed. And that was entered into the trial to prove that this guy knew about the attack ahead of time, when all it does is prove that he knew nothing about the attack ahead of time, and this was an after-the-fact conversation. So it's just... And these other people, I'm not sure what happened to them, but like I say, when you see the whole story, it just kind of makes you sick. Any other questions? Well, I'll just give you a short detail. I was flying from Narita, Japan to San Francisco to New York, and I had bought a magazine in Narita, Japan. I'll tell you how much it cost, 120 yen, which is about 10 bucks. And when you spend 10 bucks on a magazine, I mean, that's an important magazine. And I came from Narita into San Francisco at about 10 o'clock at night, had to get up at 9 in the morning to fly out to New York, go to New York. Didn't have a chance to buy any other magazines. Now, that magazine had articles on Al-Qaeda terrorists. The whole thing was covered with these articles on Al-Qaeda terrorists. And when I read it, I was just mortified. And when I read this statement, I've never been so horrified in my whole life. I couldn't believe that the guy would say to kill Americans and their allies, both civil and military. So here's the most maniacal terrorist in the world telling his followers he should kill me. I'm a civilian. Now, I'll just go into one incident I had. In July of 2000, I was in the Dusseldorf train station because I fly all around the world and do all these trips. And I had been stared at by a bunch of, they looked to me like Islamic students that were in Germany. They stared at me like they were going to kill me. I, honest to God, when I walked by them, it was in the Dusseldorf train station, I, honest to God, thought they were going to kill me right then and there. I've never seen such a look of hatred on my entire face. Walked by them and said, well, they must not like Americans. And I looked down, and I was dressed like a German. I said, oh, my God, these guys, it's not the Americans they hate. They hate the West. They hate anybody in the West. And when I read the statement, and I was going back to Dusseldorf the very next month, I'm on the plane in February, I'm going to go back to Dusseldorf in March of 2001, and I said, oh, my God, did these guys read this? They already hate us. They read this, I'm dead. I mean, I walked through the train station again, and instead of sitting there looking at me with these evil looks, they're going to do something that could be untoward. So what I did is I decided I'd better investigate this and try to find out what was behind that statement. And I realized there was an enormous paradox behind that statement. Now, who can tell me what the paradox was? Well, every action in the world has two components. And like I say, I'm an engineer. Engineers were the formulas. Every action in the world has two components, a plus component and a minus component. If I pick up this glass and move it down here, the minus component is the energy it takes to move the glass. The plus component is it gets it closer so I can have water. Well, every action has these two components. Now, I could see what the negative component with this statement was. It's in a magazine Americans could read. The military are going to read that, and they're going to go over there, and they're going to drop these bombs, these cluster bombs and these big bombs on these training camps from B-52s. So these guys were putting a bullseye right in their forehead. That was the negative. I could not see what the positive was. What in the world were they doing this for? Didn't make any sense to me. So I decided to look in this and realized after about 2 hours that, one, this was a declaration of war against the United States. Two, a declaration of war after they had been in business for 10 years had to mean they were now going to hit us with a mammoth increase in attacks. It had to be an attack inside the United States. Had to be some target inside the United States. So the next problem is, well, what's the target? That took me 45 minutes to realize it was the World Trade Center. And I immediately realized that they'd hit it in 1993. And I thought, well, in 93 they used truck bombs. They're going to be looking for truck bombs. They could either use spitballs sitting across the street, or they're going to use airplanes. I estimated they were going to use airplanes. And then it's a matter of how long does it take to train the pilots? When are they going to come into the U.S.? When are they going to be ready to go? And the analysis that I came to, even though it took me several times to analyze this, the date when they were ready was September 1st. And the date that they were going to finish the attack had to be September 15th. So it was going to be between those first 2 weeks. Now, I actually had three or four ways you could estimate the date to a week within that week, those 2 weeks. It wasn't one way. I actually had the first way was I call it the round numbers. The second way was the focus of attention. When could they actually plan the attack in Afghanistan? I found out that that meshed exactly with this 2 weeks in September. They actually had the hijacking of Air India 814 in December of 99, which confirmed that they were going from the planning phase to the execution phase. And the third way was the fact that it says it's the duty of to kill Americans and their allies, both military and civil. That's civilians. What do civilians do in the summer? They go on holiday. What do they do after the summer? They come back in September to their work. Had to be right after the summer was over. I was convinced that they were going to smash these buildings to smithereens. I came back from New York, went to California to my company, told everybody in my company those buildings were going to be obliterated in the first 2 weeks of September. I said, I've looked at this from every angle. I must have thrown every argument I could think of at it to prove it wasn't going to happen. And every argument proved it was going to happen. And I was just befuddled. I had to go to the FBI. Everybody at my company told me, Bob, you go to the FBI with this, they're going to lock you up, and they're going to throw away the goddamn key, and you're never going to get out of there. I didn't have any proof other than analyzing this one statement. I am convinced today that that statement was the precursor for the attack on the World Trade Center. I'm absolutely convinced. And I'm convinced that when they hit the coal, they didn't hit the coal because they wanted to attack the coal itself. They hit the coal because they wanted to prove they could use these four weapons, secrecy, suicide, surprise, and psychology. And if bin Laden could use those weapons, he knew he could use those weapons against any target on planet Earth. There was no target immune to those four weapons. And the coal was nothing but the proof that those four weapons were literally indefensible. And so when I went back to reanalyze it, I realized that the coal was actually the precursor to the attack on the World Trade Center. Now, before they hit the coal, they hit the Sullivans, right? But remember that in 1993, they tried to hit the World Trade Center, and they missed. So when they tried to hit the Sullivans and missed and went to hit the coal, that told me they never, never give up on a target if they missed it the first time. So the attack on 93, to me, was more confirmation that they were going after the World Trade Center. Now, who else knew that? Rick Rascola, head of security for Morgan Stanley at the South Tower, knew they were going to come after the World Trade Center, knew they were going to use airplanes, didn't put as much analysis into it as I had, and didn't know the dates. John O'Neill, Safan's boss, the guy who picked Safan for the investigation of the bombing of the coal, he knew they were going after the World Trade Center. He was killed on September 11th at the World Trade Center. I am convinced had O'Neill been at the FBI, he was disgraced and left the FBI. I was convinced if he'd been at the FBI, Bongard would have gone to O'Neill and said, look, you don't let these people take this investigation away from us. But he was literally disgraced by the top people of the FBI and literally forced out when, A, they knew that there was a huge attack, and, B, they knew he was their number one counterterrorism official and their best expert on al-Qaeda terrorists. They forced him out. Now, why would the FBI force some guy out when they know this huge attack is about to take place and they know all these people are going to be killed? It doesn't make any sense in my book. But what had happened is in Florida, in the New York Times, it was reported that O'Neill had lost his laptop, and it was found very shortly after that, and it had secret information, but none of the information had been compromised. That ended up in the front page of the New York Times. And O'Neill, when he saw that, he thought, oh, my God, I'm disgraced. He left on August 22nd. The photographs of Midhar and Hazmi came over to the FBI on August 23rd. Now, that's a real coincidence. So now I'm not trying to draw these coincidences to show that there's a connection, but clearly you can see from the information I presented there's an ironclad connection between withholding material information from an ongoing FBI investigation and that this had to be criminal in effect. Okay, but those are excellent questions. I love your questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You've got an excellent question. Why didn't Bongard himself check with NSLU and find out that this ruling was fabricated? God only knows. And personally, I would not call Steve and say, Steve, why didn't you check on this? Because in my opinion, Steve Bongard is a hero. But for some reason, he didn't go back. The issue was, the way these rulings were made, FBI headquarters agents went to the attorney, presented a case. It was one-sided, her version only, orally took the ruling and then gave the ruling back to FBI field agents. The field agent was not involved, didn't contact the attorney, didn't even know who the attorney was, got the ruling back orally. And I guess the process is, if you're left out of the process to contact the attorney, you don't feel like it's your duty or your right to go back to the attorney to find out what the ruling is. And unfortunately, I mean, now my personal opinion is in the book. I put in the book that if we want to keep America safe, we should have a process where both the field agent and the headquarters agent talk to the attorney. It's all transcripted. It's all written down. And a written report is given back to the field agent. Had they done that, they would have prevented 9/11. But you've got an excellent point. And, I mean, you, right off the bat, you picked up right on here what was the major issue. Why didn't Steve have any contact with the attorney to know that this was a complete fabrication? He knew there was no FISA component. Every single agent in the FBI is what? A lawyer. They have to be lawyers to be hired by the FBI. He clearly knew the rules of evidence. So he knew that Corsi was completely off course. But when she told him that he was going to be fired if he had anything to do with the Midhar investigation, he knew he was just toast at that point. But any other questions? Because anybody can get a multi-entry visa for the United States. The issue isn't the multi-entry visa. It's the issue that the CIA found out he had the multi-entry. You can, if you're a Saudi citizen, they have this thing called Fast Track, and you can go into like a consulate and get a visa very quickly. I think you don't even have to show up, and they give you these visas. And yeah, it's an express program. And so that was actually natural. And what a multi-entry visa means, you can go to the U.S., come back, and go back again, and go back multiple times. Now, why would a terrorist have a multi-entry visa for the U.S.? To carry out a terrorist act, right? I mean, what's he going to do over here? He's not going to be playing tiddlywinks. As Bongard said, he's sure not going to be going to effing Disneyland. And he told Corsi that. He said he's not going to be going to Disneyland. He knew darn well he was over here to carry out a terrorist act. Now, on the visa, it's got New York City. The visas he got says New York City. Now, that should have been a dead giveaway right then and there. But it was standard process to give these agents or to give these Saudi people multi-entry visas. Now, that's not an issue. The issue was that the CIA knew he had this visa, knew he was a terrorist, knew he was an al-Qaeda terrorist, knew he had taken part in Tanzania and Kenya bombings and didn't do anything about it, didn't put him on a watch list, didn't tell the FBI. So,
Bob, as I reviewed the evidence that you've compiled and the dots you've connected, it occurred to me that if this was presented, as you've presented it here, to a grand jury, that it might well convince that jury of what you're suggesting here, that there was a criminal conspiracy to obstruct justice. Have you taken this material to a lawyer? Have you taken it to any attorneys general in any of the states impacted by 9/11?
Nope.
For their consideration to open up an investigation and convene a grand jury?
Well, the issue is, I don't think, again, it's the same issue that I had with the FBI. Being outside the agency, I don't think you'd have any credibility unless you were actually part of the Department of Justice. And they had this guy, I think his name was David Hunter. He was, or some other guy, he was investigating the CIA for destroying the tapes, interview tapes of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi Bin al-Shib. And they actually have an investigation for the destruction of those tapes because they were supposed to have been entered into the 9/11 hearings. They were supposed to have been entered into the Massawi trial. Judge Brinkema at the Massawi trial said, I want those tapes preserved of the interview of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And they were destroyed. So they were destroying evidence that the judge had herself ordered. So that's a crime, another crime. But it turns out, at this point, I mean, I think the CIA has committed so many crimes, they're just uncountable at this point. I think, I mean, they've gone around the world kidnapping people, assassinating people.
I'm talking about the FBI or an attorney general.
The problem is
basically going after those that withheld the critical intelligence repeatedly.
I mean, it's obvious, but now think of it, everybody. This information is out in the world. I'm not coming up with something new. I'm just simply compiling what's already there, and I'm putting it in a nice timeline. There was no reason the 9/11 Commission and the FBI, the Justice Department investigators didn't come up with the same thing. There's no possible way that the Department of Justice didn't know who Safwan was. The Department of Justice is over the FBI. Safwan was lead investigator on the FBI. There's no possible way they didn't know that Corsi had received this release before she tells Bongart he can't be part of this investigation. There is absolutely no possible way they didn't know who Wilshire was. He was working for the FBI. They had his emails. They had all this, and yet this got left out of those two investigations. Now, I mean, if there's that kind of collusion to hide this information, what chance have I got to present this to anybody? They're going to say the same thing. Well, we already know about it. Nothing happened. And obviously the problem is there's a lot of political pressure to make sure that these investigations don't take place, unfortunately. I mean, you have to ask the question, why would they put $7 billion out and give all this money to these people that were killed, the relatives who were killed on 9/11, if it wasn't to keep much of this out of the courts? They didn't want this in the courts where the CIA would have no capability to control the information. And it's clear that when the CIA got in front of the 9/11 Commission, they basically dissembled on the information they gave to the 9/11 Commission. I was at the hearing when Tim Romer said to George Tenet, "George, you knew there was a big attack." "Yes, I did." "You knew thousands of Americans would be killed." "Yes, I did." "Why didn't you tell the president in August?" And Tenet says that he didn't talk to the president in August. And Romer comes back and says, "Well, you didn't call him on the telephone?" "No." "Why didn't you call him on the telephone?" "Well, I can't explain why I didn't call him on the telephone." Bill Harlow came right out and said Tenet had made a mistake.
Who's Bill Harlow?
Bill Harlow is a spokesman for the CIA, and said Tenet made a mistake. He'd actually flown down to Crawford on the 17th, talked to Bush on the 31st in Washington, but it turns out that he'd flown down there on the 24th on a flight to Crawford that nobody is aware of, that was kept secret. And on that flight, Tenet knew that Midhar and Hazmi were in the U.S., knew they were going to take part in this huge attack, and knew Massawi had been arrested at Minneapolis. And clearly, I mean, the question is, did he tell George Bush? Well, we don't know, since we don't know what the communication was, because since it was all oral. So, but you've got an excellent point. What can we do about it? God only knows. I think unfortunately it's been covered over, and I think there's enough momentum at the top end of government to keep this under wraps. That there's, I mean, you're pushing a rope up a hill, basically. So basically, what my modus operandi was to put a book out. The book essentially had been about my experience on 9/11 and not about the CIA and FBI, and only got involved in that after I tried to look at it and the things just didn't add up. I could not figure out how they would know about these two terrorists for 2 years, almost 2 years, and not give this information to the FBI. That made no sense. So I was heavily motivated to find out what had gone on.
Bob, I just wanted to say for the record, yesterday Representative Dennis Kucinich called for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to investigate the actions of the Bush administration in the last 8 years. In an article in rawstory.com, he's interviewed in a follow-up interview. He says that he would like to look at the 9/11 Commission. So at least it's on the table. It would take a lot of support, public support, and clamor and so on for this to happen. And for the Democratic leadership to actually take this up in a vote. But at least you have one member saying, we need to investigate what happened these last 8 years, and is willing to go back and take a look at the findings of the 9/11 Commission.
But I think it's real clear when you look at this that there's been a big effort to keep this swept under the rug. And, I mean, here I am a person. I'm an engineer. I'm not a journalist. You guys are journalists, right? Why am I writing a book when I'm an engineer? I should be writing software and get my software helps engineers design chips. That's what I should be doing. Why am I writing a book? You guys should have written the book. This should have been your book. And of course you can see.
They get fired.
What?
They get fired.
Well, that probably is true, but and you can see when you, you know, some of the writing's a little awkward because, you know, engineers can't write. They know, and everybody knows they can't write. But I put this book together because I wanted to get this off my head, and I definitely wanted to feel like, I definitely wanted to find out, was I responsible for these attacks? What did I
responsible for not having,
done
tried
anything
to warn people, right?
And
in that sense.
I don't think anyone would blame you, frankly.
Well, the issue isn't that anybody would blame you. It's can I not blame myself? And I have never gotten to the point where I can't blame. I have blamed myself from day one. I must have gone over this thing hundreds of thousands of times a day. I went through the Logan Airport on the 8th of September looking for the terrorists. And I thought, my God, if I for sure spot them out at Logan Airport, they're going to be trying to figure out how to get those 4-inch knives to security. When I spot them, I'll go to the FBI. I'll have the information that I need. And I missed them by 3 hours. Missed them by 3 hours. And without that kind of information, you were just dead. They already had Massawi. Maltby was already shutting down Harry Sammet's investigation of Massawi. And if I didn't have at least that kind of credible information, I was just dead. So I, honest to God, I mean, the whole thing was so horrific for me. Like I say, the day it happened, I thought, oh, my God, I just killed all those people. Oh, my God. And I thought, how am I going to live through this? And I was mortified. I couldn't believe how I was going to recover from the psychological impact. That you knew the entire attack was going to take place. You couldn't do anything about it. It was just horrific. So if you want to know why I put so much effort into it, it was kind of to assuage my guilt in the whole affair, and then to try to find out what was the real reason these attacks happened. I knew the 9/11 Commission didn't come up with the right numbers. Didn't make any sense. And I think I have put together a book that's as complete as can be. And just give me your kind of your first assessment. What do you guys think? I mean, at least from the presentation here. Now, like I say, if you read the summary, the summary has a quick view of what's in the book, and it also has every bit of source information. So every place it says defense evidence item 939 Massawi trial, and of course I put that 939 item in there. So I've actually sourced it right in the summary, so you don't have to read the whole book, but you can read the whole book, but in about 10 pages and go through the whole thing and see the entire thing in one shot, and every piece of source information is there. If you want any more source information, send me an email if you have my email address. Send me some email. I'll send you back every source document I've got. I'll send you back the DOJ report. And I actually converted that to Word, so you can actually search it in Word, which makes it real easy. I have Safon's account in Word. I have the 9/11 Commission report in Word. I have the Joint Inquiry Committee of the House and Senate report in Word. So I've converted these into Word. And I converted them to Word so I could actually write a book because I didn't want to write it off of the PDF. So, and now what's your opinion of this? So the issue now, what do you think can happen from here? I mean, the issue is, obviously, a lot of this has been swept under the rug. I mean, how do you get this information out to the whole world? I mean, I think that the people who lost their relatives have got to be just mortified.
Just hope for some kind of another opportunity to bring information forward.
Well, here's the horrible part. If these people have gotten away with this, they clearly what they did, they committed crimes at the CIA, and if people at the CIA can commit crimes and hide information from the FBI that could prevent mammoth attacks, what does that say for our security? It doesn't bode well for our security. And I think the 9/11 Commission, it was their charter to find this out, get the people in the CIA who were responsible, at least get them out of there, and then put in place, and you had a very good point, why didn't Steve Bongart go to the NSL attorney? So they should put in place new rules. For example, I told you that Doug Miller wrote that.